Good morning, everyone. My name is Rob Lazaro, and I'm a member of the team here that supports our monthly Saturday breakfast meetings. I'm delighted to be with you this morning to have the opportunity to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. John Lennox. John is a professor of mathematics in the University of Oxford and a fellow in mathematics and the philosophy of science at Green Templeton College of Oxford. He's also an adjunct lecturer at Wycliffe Hall, Oxford University, and teaches for the Oxford Strategic Leadership Program at the Executive Education Center at Oxford's Business School. An accomplished author, John has lectured extensively in North America, Eastern and Western Europe on mathematics, the philosophy of science, and the intellectual defense of Christianity. Today, John will be speaking to us on the subject, Is God a Delusion? There'll be an opportunity for questions at the conclusion of John's talk. We ask that your questions be written down during the talk, so there should be paper and pencils on each table to provide you with that, and then we'll collect them afterwards. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming John Lennox.
Well, I nearly said good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, gentlemen. And thank you very much for your invitation. It seems to be a little bit early in the morning to embark on serious thought, but I am encouraged at least a little bit by the accepted definition of a mathematician, which is a person who talks in other people's sleep. And unfortunately, there is a ring of truth about that from my own experience. But it's lovely to be with you. Every speaker's got a biography, and sometimes talks like this can appear to be rather one-dimensional if you do not know something at least about the person addressing you. So very briefly, you've already realized I come from Northern Ireland, which is one of my problems, and I arrived in Cambridge in the middle of the last century a long time ago and found that my Irish heritage was something controversial, because I recall in my very first week as a student, another student said to me, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "Oh, sorry, you're Irish, I forgot. All you Irish, you believe in God and you fight about it." And of course I'd heard that before, but somehow it seemed to me in those days that it was very important for me to face that question at a new level. My parents were believers. My grandparents also. But they were wonderful parents, because in a sectarian country, they were not sectarian, although they were Christian. And secondly, they gave me the greatest gift that any parents can give their children, and that is they allowed me to think and encouraged me to read very widely, way beyond the confines of their own confessional position. And so when I got to university, I didn't feel that I was saddled with a whole lot of sectarian bias. But what I'd never done before, because I'd never had the opportunity, was to get to know people at a really deep level who did not share my worldview. And I decided I needed to do that. What makes an atheist or an agnostic tick? And in that first week, I didn't know that this was going to set the focus of my life, really. I studied mathematics, did my PhD, got a job at Cardiff in Wales, and then, having been advised to go to Germany to do some work, I spent a year in Würzburg and learned the language, and that opened up the way into Eastern Europe. And I spent a lot of time during the Cold War going to particularly Eastern Germany, Poland and Hungary, and talking to people who'd been systematically exposed to atheism as a worldview. And when the wall fell, I've been a Russian translator most of my life, and so it naturally opened up the possibility of going to Siberia on a two-way ticket, by the way, and entering into discussion with people who had never, ever been exposed to the kind of argument that I've been developing over the years. And so for the past, since 1989, I've been a regular visitor to Russia and also to Ukraine and the countries around the former Soviet Union. Interested in the public space discussing these big questions that have now come into our society and are of, I discover, enormous interest to audiences around the world, reflected in part by the number of you here today. And as you possibly know, I've had the opportunity to debate many of the leading atheists in the world, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Victor Stenger, Professor Peter Singer, and quite a number of others, Peter Atkins and so on. And I do that for a very simple reason, because I believe it's very important in an age of political correctness to have in the public space a reasoned, friendly debate about these very big issues, because they are too important to keep silent about them. So I want to argue for that public space. And what I have been asked to talk about this morning is faith a delusion? And the title of the talk is essentially a reflection of Richard Dawkins' best-selling book, The God Delusion. And I have studied that book in great detail, debated him on its contents. And it has interested me because the title is essentially a psychiatric title. A delusion, of course, is a persistent false belief held in the face of strong contradictory evidence, especially as a symptom of psychiatric disorder. And I'm taking that definition from Dawkins' book. And he makes the comment that perhaps he leave aside at the start the psychiatric thing, but concentrate on this persistent false belief held in the face of strong contradictory evidence. Well, Richard Dawkins is not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychiatrist either. I'm a professor of mathematics. And so if you're not a psychiatrist and you're reading things about psychiatry, the best thing to do is consult a psychiatrist. And I was very interested to discover that relatively recently, Professor Andrew Sims, who's a former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, has written a book, Is Faith Delusional? And he writes in it this, the advantageous effect of religious belief and spirituality on mental and physical health is one of the best kept secrets in psychiatry and medicine generally. If the findings of the huge volume of research on this topic had gone in the opposite direction, and it had been found that religion damages your mental health, it would have been front page news in every newspaper in the land. The statement, he adds, that all religious belief is delusion is both erroneous and innately hostile. The suggestion that faith is delusional does not help psychiatric patients for whom the religious faith may be very important. And he summarizes his findings like this, although the content of delusion may be religious, the whole of belief of itself is not and cannot be a delusion. That's what a psychiatrist says. Now the interesting thing about that is that we face today an onslaught in the name of science against God. Richard Dawkins claims to approach these things scientifically, but actually when I analyze whether he has done so or not, I find him sadly wanting. He has made a statement which bears in to the status of faith, and in my case the Christian faith, and assigned it to a psychological category to which it doesn't belong. And the scientists agree that it doesn't belong. Indeed, Andrew Sims refers to major studies that have been done recently on the positive aspects of the influence of faith in God on all kinds of social indicators, like drug abuse, breakdown in marriage, and so on. And in every case, they come out positive. And he's pointing out here that if the results had gone the other way, they'd have been front page news. Every atheist in the world would have been saying, religion is bad for you, and so on. Well, because the studies have shown it. Dawkins is saying it's bad for you, it's a virus, but he has no scientific backing for it. So I think my first point is this, and I'm going to make several like this, is his concept of a delusion, of faith being a delusion, is itself a delusion. And in that connection, I want to suggest to you that many of my atheist friends are deluded into thinking that Freud supports their contention. You know, related to this idea that God is a delusion is the old notion taken up by Marx that religion is the opium of the people, which it can be, of course. But the idea that God is a wish fulfillment, a projection of our desire to have a father figure in the sky and some sort of peace and rest and pie in the sky when you die and so on. And many people have bought into that, not realizing that it's a two-edged sword. And I think the best expression of it has been in a book by Manfred Lutz, who's one of Germany's leading psychiatrists. He's written a book called Eine kleine Geschichte des Größten. It's not in English yet. A Brief History of the Great One. And the point he makes in that is simply this. He said, look, if there is no God, Freud gives you a brilliant argument for thinking that religion is delusional, it's a wish fulfillment and so on, if there is no God. But he says, equally and oppositely, if there is a God, then Freud gives you a brilliant argument for thinking that atheism is a delusion. And I quote here Czesław Miłosz, who wrote, a Nobel Prize winning Polish author, who wrote a book, The Discreet Charm of Nihilism. And he says, a true opium of the people is a belief in nothingness after death, the huge solace of thinking that for our betrayals, greed, cowardice, murders, we are not going to be judged. So if God does exist, Freud's argument will tell you that atheism is a psychological escape mechanism to avoid facing reality and taking ultimate responsibility for my own life. And then Lutz delivers his final blow, and it's a very important one, it seems to me. He says, Freud's arguments are great, depending on which premise you assume. But on the central question, whether God exists or not, Freud, Jung and Frankl, nor any of the others, they cannot help you at all. You will have to look elsewhere for your evidence. And that, to my mind, is a very important thing to see, that it works both ways. So the question then comes, what is the evidence for the existence of God? But the moment I use the word evidence, we come now to another atheist delusion. And Richard Dawkins, I quote again because people know him better than anyone else, I suppose. Let's listen to his definition of faith. Faith, being belief that isn't based on evidence, is the principal vice of any religion. He writes very well. But that's completely false. You can write very well, but what you're saying may be false. Faith, what is faith? Well, it comes from the Latin fide, so my OED tells me, from which we get the word fidelity. And now I quote the Oxford English Dictionary. Basic meaning is belief, trust, that which produces belief, evidence, belief proceeding from reliance on testimony or authority. The words belief, faith and trust mean essentially the same. And as I say these days, all of us in this room know exactly what I mean when I talk about evidence-based faith. We've had a financial crisis. It has led to a breakdown in trust. It has led to the freezing up to a certain extent of the financial sector until trust is regained, because trust can only exist where there is evidence. And if you want to build a house and go into your bank manager, you will have to persuade him or her to trust you. So you'll have to provide evidence for it. And all of us, we know exactly what this means. Faith that isn't based on evidence is a very dangerous thing. Now, the question for me as a Christian, and other religious traditions have every right and should answer this question for themselves. I have no right to answer for them. But as far as Christianity is concerned, is faith is squarely evidence-based. And that's easy to see. The fourth gospel written by John, at the end of it, he says why he is writing it. And he says, you know, Jesus did many other things in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written in order that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. In other words, here is the evidence upon which faith can be based. If Christianity were a faith not based on evidence, you wouldn't want the New Testament, would you? Because that is the evidence, or part of it. You wouldn't want Christian experience, because that's part of the evidence too. It is sheer nonsense, gentlemen, to suggest that Christianity involves a great leap in the dark where there's no evidence. Dawkins is totally wrong about this. And one of the clever things that the so-called new atheists have done is to redefine the concept of faith. They have made it, turned it from an ordinary concept, which we're all used to using, into a religious concept, and they have changed its meaning to belief where there is no evidence. And therefore, when they meet someone like me, Richard Dawkins calls me a man of faith, which sounds very flattering, but actually it's an insult. Because what he means is, Lennox believes where there's no evidence, so there's no point in talking to him. And that's a very cheap way out of the situation, because you see what it does. It means that people who say they're interested in evidence, say they're rational, say that they're scientific, when I start to talk to them about the evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, they say, well, why would anybody be interested in that? It's exactly what Dawkins said to me. You see, they're not interested in evidence. And that I see as the mark of the anti-intellectual and the anti-scholar. Sorry to be so strong, gentlemen, but strong statements are made on all sides in this debate, and we have to call a spade a spade. I'm not impressed with that as a scientist. When you go outside your own field, as I'm going this morning, and I'm aware of it, I am a mathematician, so I'm going outside my own field. The one thing you must do is check the best evidence of your opponent, not the worst evidence. And you must analyze to see what they actually claim. Now, of course, that leads to another delusion, that faith is blind. I've tried to explain that faith is not blind. Faith is based on evidence. But it leads to some hilarious conclusions. Richard Dawkins says, atheists have no faith. And Peter Singer, I'll tell you about a little chat I had. Well, it wasn't a chat, it was a public debate in front of more than 1,000 people in Australia not long ago. Where we were debating this kind of topic, you see. And Peter Singer said, you see, of course, my problem is with religion is that people usually remain in the religion in which they've been brought up. I just told them, as I've told you, honestly, that my parents were believers and so on. And he said, that's it. You remain the religion in which you brought up. So he said this. So when I got the chance to speak, I said, Peter, let's try and square this up a bit. Let me ask you, what about your parents? Were they atheists? Oh, yes, he said, they were atheists. Oh, I said, you remained in the faith in which you were brought up then, too. Oh, he said, but it isn't a faith. Oh, I said, I'm sorry, Peter, I was under the impression you believed it. Now, that little conversation shows the depth of confusion to which even some of the world's leading intellectuals have come. It isn't a faith, and yet the whole thing is about his belief in it. Because they feel that a faith is a set of beliefs that are held without evidence, and because atheism is, in their opinion, not that, it's not a faith. And Christopher Hitchens, even better. Poor old Christopher, I did get on well with him, and sad that he's died. Christopher said, you know, if you have to have faith to believe something, that diminishes the probability that it's true. So when I was debating him, I said, Christopher, do you believe that you exist? Because if you believe you exist, that involves faith, so it diminishes the probability that you do exist. It's just sheer nonsense, and it comes from this twisting of the definition of faith as a commitment based on evidence. And when it is dealing with a commitment to God, of course, and I'd like to say this before I forget to say it, is that faith in God is not simply faith in a theory. God is a person, not a theory. And therefore, faith in God involves a multi-dimensional commitment. And the analogy of marriage, of course, is readily at hand. I don't trust my wife for no reason, you know. Don't know everything about her, and I didn't when I married her 43 years ago. But I have endless reasons for trusting and loving her. That personal commitment is based on evidence. But it's a broad spectrum of kinds of evidence. It's not only intellectual propositional evidence. It's emotional, intuitive, experiential as well. And this is enormously important. But now, this deluded definition of faith leads to another very serious consequence, and it's that faith has no role in science. You know, atheists have no faith, we have no beliefs, etc. This is such sheer nonsense, even from a scientific perspective. And Einstein, of course, saw that very clearly. He said, I cannot imagine a scientist without that deep faith. What faith? Well, every scientist, including me, believes that the universe is at least in part accessible to the human mind. Now, why is that so? It takes a really bright person to see that that's a problem. Eugen Wigner wrote a brilliant paper in 1961, much loved of mathematicians, and it's called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. Here's a mathematician, she's thinking in here about the universe out there, comes up with equations that describe something out there. How does that work? How is it that we can invent a symbolism in here that actually so accurately appears to reflect what's going on out there that we can do something with it? That is absolutely stupendous. But we're so used to it, you see, that we don't realize what's going on. And he talked about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. I don't think it's unreasonable. The question of whether it's reasonable or unreasonable depends entirely on your worldview. And at the heart of the current debate is the worldview question. Let me put it to you this way. There are several families of worldviews. I'm going to talk about two of them. Right from the ancient world, we've had two fundamental, or possibly three, ways of looking at the universe. One is that this universe is all that exists. Mass and energy are the ultimate things that exist, and therefore the things that explain everything else. So that all explanation must be reductionist in the sense that it must proceed bottom up from mass energy. Or, turning it the other way round, you must be able to reduce mind to brain, brain to biochemistry, biochemistry to chemistry to physics, and in the end, mathematics. You must be able to explain it exhaustively and from the bottom up. But in the ancient world, there were others who believe that there's something more. In fact, the majority, if you look through history, of the great thinkers believe there was something more. There is transcendence. And so, barreling up through history, coming into contemporary Oxford, say, there are those two worldviews. As they say, there are others, but these will have to do because these are where the focus of the debate occurs, in the West at least. And that is, the universe is all that exists, or it isn't all that exists. There is a God who created it and maintained it. The one view we call naturalism, the other view we call theism. And I think the real question is, not that science is at war with religion at all. Those conflicts are very superficial, and you may want to discuss some of them. The real conflict is between those two worldviews, and there are scientists on both sides. It ought to be obvious by now that the real issue is not science versus God, because go right up to the top of the science scale. Take the Human Genome Project. Its first director was Jim Watson, an outspoken atheist, won the Nobel Prize with Francis Crick. Its second director, Francis Collins, who's now the director of the National Institute of Health, they're both senior medical position in the United States, is a Christian. So here are two men at the very top of science, impeccable scientific credentials, but they're on opposite sides of the worldview debate. One is an atheist, the other is a Christian theist. So it must be clear, or at least it ought to be, that the conflict cannot simply be at the level of science versus God. It's at the worldview level. And therefore, my question is, how does science itself fit into that picture? What I mean by that is this. I've talked to you about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, and it is unreasonable, I would suggest to you, on the basis of the atheist hypothesis. Why is that? Because my atheist friends tell me that the mind with which I do science is the brain. The brain is the end product of a mindless, unguided process that didn't have it in mind. I put to you, if the computer on your desk, if you knew it was the end product of a mindless, unguided process that didn't have it in mind, you'd never use it. You wouldn't trust it. And this was seen long ago by J.B.S. Haldane, a chemist, who said, you know, if the thoughts in my mind are simply the random motions of atoms in my brain, why should I believe anything my brain tells me, including the fact that it is composed of atoms? C.S. Lewis, commenting in his usual pithy way, said, it's like a man sitting on a tree cutting off the branch on which he sits. Now, I take this as the major objection as a scientist that I have to the atheist paradigm. It's not that it's anti-God, that goes with the turf. It's that it's anti-science. It undermines the rationality that we need to do science, because it's telling me that the apparatus with which I do science is effectively unreliable. Now, this has become such a major problem that some of the leading philosophers of the world are trying to deal with it. And they're not succeeding very well. And on the Christian side, Alvin Plantinga, one of the world's most distinguished philosophers, incidentally, at Notre Dame University in the States, has written a brilliant book just recently called Where the Real Problem Lies. And where the real problem lies, and he uses Dawkins as one of his examples, is that Dawkins, two sides of Dawkins are at war with each other. He says he's keen on science, but his view of science undermines the very concept of rationality with which he's supposed to be doing the science. And so the thing falls into incoherence. I was taught quantum mechanics at Cambridge by Professor Sir John Polkinghorne. And in many of his books he points this out, you know, if you reduce thought to the firing of synapses in the brain, you destroy all possibility of meaning. So that on the hypothesis that there is no God, that there is no transcendence, science collapses. And now let's turn that upside down. Why do I believe that mathematics is not unreasonably effective? Because the Christian worldview, and it's shared by Judaism and Islam at this level, is that the reason my mind in here can understand in part the universe out there is that they both are traceable to the same creator. And now, if we look back at the history of science, we'll discover those two match. Because science exploded in the 16th and 17th centuries under people like Galileo and Kepler and Newton and so on, all of whom were believers in God. And that circumstance has exercised philosophers of science for a very long time. And the general consensus, with various nuances, was well put together by C.S. Lewis, who says, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a law giver. In other words, far from hindering science, belief in God was the motor that drove it. Now that, to my mind, is fascinating. I gave the very first lecture in 75 years in the University of Novosibirsk, the elite university where Yeltsin got many of his top leaders, on why I believed in God. And I mentioned this, that these people believed in God, and I could see people getting really angry. And you know, when people get angry in front of you, and the communists are still in charge, and the KGB is sitting listening to you, you stop. And I looked at a professor in the front row, and I said, why are you angry? He said, don't you realize? He said, this is the first time any of us in this room have ever heard that Newton was a believer in God, that Kepler was a believer in God, that Galileo was a believer in God. Why did they never tell us? I said, can't you guess? But that's very interesting. The suppression of history, but it's being suppressed in our own society. People are not aware of these things. The intimate link between the notion of God creating what we call a contingent universe. He could have created it any way he liked. So if you want to find out how it works, there's no use just sitting in your study. You have to do experiments. You have to observe. That was the thing that really drove science. It didn't happen in China. There was a lot of technology in China. And Joseph Needham, a very famous Oxford chemist, but one of the most brilliant sinologists that there's been, wrote the definitive history of technology and science in China. Tried for years, because he was a neo-Marxist, to explain the lack of a rise of modern science in China. in the abstract sense that we know it. And he had to admit in the end that the only thing he could see that was different was that in Europe they had the concept of a single God who created and gave order to the universe. Now, therefore, gentlemen, you might see the significance in the following statement. Far from being ashamed of being a scientist and a Christian, it's the exact opposite. It was Christianity gave me my subject. Now, what we're facing in our society is another delusion. It's that you have to choose between God and science. I read the book by Stephen Hawking and Larry Mladenov, you know, Leonard Mladenov, The Grand Design, and I couldn't believe the Daily Mail here asked me to do a page on it at about an hour's notice, and I did that in the end, and it turned into a little book, which I think is over there. Stephen Hawking and God. Whose design is it anyway? And what fascinated me about that was here was Hawking, who's just ahead of me in Cambridge and is light years ahead of me in his brain power, saying that you have to choose between science and God. And you know, going into schools, I find 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds even who can see through that. Choosing between science and God is very much like choosing between two sets of explanations for a Ford motor car. One set is the law of internal combustion plus clever mechanical engineering. The other explanation is Henry Ford. Choose. And it's absurd. In order to have a complete explanation of a Ford motor car, you have to have an explanation in terms of the agent who designed it and conceived it. And the laws, internal combustion, and the mechanisms by which it works. There are different kinds and levels of explanation. And to say that Henry Ford competes or is an alternative explanation to internal combustion and engineering is pathetically absurd, isn't it? And I find kids can see it immediately. And yet I find some of the leading scientists in the world can't see it because they've been brainwashed into believing that science is the only way to truth. Bertrand Russell once said, although he didn't entirely believe it, and that's another story, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Now, it may be a bit early in the morning for this kind of logic, but try and follow me. Think of that statement, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Is it a scientific statement? No, it isn't. So you cannot know it. Have you got it? It contradicts itself. Because it's a statement of his belief. And because it's not a statement of science, if it's true, it's false. And that's what we call logical incoherence. He went too far. And the Nobel Prize winner, Peter Medawar, he was much more cautious. And he said this, look, it does no service to science to think that it can explain everything. It can't even handle the simple questions of a child. Where have I come from? Where am I going to? And what is the meaning of life? We have to look beyond science. Science has been wonderfully successful. And I'm passionate about it. Because it has narrowed the field of questions. And what we need to realize is that there are bigger questions. Now, if you take the view that science is the only way to truth, you will be inwardly driven to increase the realm of science to include everything. And we're seeing a very big drive to do that in our contemporary society today. And the area, the new area to be conquered is morality. You see, traditionally we have had in the West our morality defined by God. It has had a vertical dimension. But if God is out of the picture, you've got to find your morality down here, in there. So what are you going to base it on? Are you going to base it on raw nature and genetics? Are you going to base it on society? And people are floundering in Europe all the time because they've discovered that if you look, say, at the animal world, you can construct any morality you like. Darwin was a kindly gentleman with a nice long beard, and he watched ants cooperating, and he said there's a base for altruism. Spencer saw nature as a competition, the survival of the fittest. We all know what that led to when it's been applied at the level of social engineering. Where do you go? And we're floundering because I would suggest to you that Dostoevsky was right when he said, if there is no God, everything is permissible. He didn't mean that atheists couldn't behave morally. That's nonsense. Of course they can. My atheist friends could put me to shame. But what he was saying is there's no rational base. And we've got to face this, ladies and gentlemen. There are one or two people who are beginning to see the implications that Nietzsche saw long, long ago. That if you eject God, you don't leave human beings as stable and having value. Many of my Russian friends have said, you know, Dostoevsky was a prophet. And I remember one academic saying to me, almost with tears in his eyes, he said, you know, John, we thought that we could get rid of God and keep a value for human beings, and we found we couldn't. From where I sit, you, every one of you, is of infinite value, a person made in the image of God. There is a tremendous pressure these days to reduce you to either a machine or an animal or a combination of the two, without ultimate meaning. And I've been told it straight by many of my colleagues. Devalued of ultimate meaning. And it seems to me that that is, in a way, delusional. What I've been trying to say to you this morning is that it seems to me there's strong evidence, even from within the realm of science, that there's got to be something more. And I spent my life putting my faith on the line because I want to know whether it's true or not. I don't want to be fooled. And my conclusion over all those years is that there is more. And what is more? God is not remote and unknowable. And now here's the bigger thing. The God who created the universe and upholds it, I believe, has spoken to us. That's not very surprising, is it? Because we are persons. And you know, if we are sitting together in a room and I never say anything, you'll never get to know me, will you? And I'll never get to know you. I can only get to know you to the extent to which you're prepared to reveal yourself to me. And the central claim of Christianity is that it's not simply a question of human beings with very bright intellects trying to explore the transcendent and create it in their own imagination. Oh, it's infinitely bigger than that. It's that the creator of the universe has personally come into our world. The Word has become human. And you know, I'll finish on that because I see the time is up. There are two views of reality, in a way. And one starts in the beginning of the particles, and the particles somehow formed the universe, and the universe somehow produced life, and life somehow produced consciousness, and consciousness somehow produced you. And you produced the idea of God because there isn't a God. That's one view. The other view is in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by Him. And that puts the stark contrast between these two worldviews. In the atheist worldview, matter is primary and mind is derivative. In the Christian worldview, it's the exact opposite. Mind is primary, logos, God is primary, and mass energy is derivative. And all I can say is, and I have many other reasons to adduce for it, all I can say is, it's the one that begins with the Word that makes far more sense to me as a scientist than the alternative. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, I have got a selection of your questions, and I shall now try to see if I can make some sense of them, and you will discover very soon how limited I am. But it's always very interesting to see the questions. They bunch, of course. There are several people asking the same thing. So this is a time when I try to engage with what you're thinking. And it's got all the limitations of that, because every one of these questions I would be happy to spend a long time on, because they're all very interesting and questions that are being asked around the place. So what I've got to try to do is the impossible, and that is, in a kind of telegraphic style, give you an initial approach to the questions. So I don't pretend to give final answers. That would be to insult your intelligence. It's that here's how I begin to approach them. Now, the first question is, where did Bertrand Russell say the statement that you quoted? It's one of the most un-Russell-like statements I have heard. Well, you did detect that I felt the same as you do, because Bertrand Russell did not himself accept the notion of scientism. But what I should have said, had I unpacked that a little bit more extensively, is that he gave one of the best definitions of it. And you'll find the quote, one of my books over there, God's Undertaker, Science Buried God. Don't have to buy the book, just look up at the back, Bertrand Russell, and you'll find where the quote comes from. I used Russell not because he believed it. Actually, Russell was quite impressed, incidentally, by the argument from design, but because he formulated it as succinctly as anybody I have heard. Exponent of scientism, as we call it. Science is the only way to truth. Peter Atkins, and on YouTube you can see a debate that lasts for about 90 minutes between me and Atkins on this, amongst other issues. Now, here's the shortest question of the lot, which is a very common question, and it forms the heart of Richard Dawkins' book, Who Created God? And I meet it, well, I was amazed to meet it in A Scientist. I was even more amazed that Peter Singer threw it at me in Australia. Because it sounds very impressive, but if you analyse it, well, let's try. Is it not too early yet for logic? It's getting later in the day. So let's have a look at it. Who created X? What does that statement mean? Well, it assumes that X is created. Who created X? It assumes X is created. So if you ask the question, who created God, you're assuming before you start that God's created. Now, philosophers have a name for this. They call it a complex question. They don't mean it's complicated. What they mean is that it removes off the table the only possible answer that would make sense. It restricts the field of answers, because it redefines the object and tells you what the object is. And here the object is a created God, by definition. And perhaps I could put it this way. If Richard Dawkins had written a book called The Created God's Delusion, nobody would have bought it. Because we know that created gods are delusion. We normally call them idols. Do you see the point? It sounds impressive, but it doesn't work. But it's a two-edged sword. And when Dawkins himself put it to me, I pointed this out to him, of course, that it bypasses the central claim of the three great monotheistic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that God wasn't created. So the question doesn't even apply to an uncreated God. And I thought I'd left this question behind in Russia, because I used to get it a lot in Russia, where it was hilarious. Because they would say to me, you know, if you believe in God, a creator, you must ask who created God. Well, I said, that shows me that you have a difficulty with the concept of the eternal. Tell me what you believe in the universe, about the universe. They say it's always been there. Oh, I said, so you do believe in something eternal. You believe it wasn't created. So your difficulty is not in principle with something uncreated. You cannot believe in an uncreated person. That's a different question. Do you see? That's point number two. But point number three is this. The question is valid for created gods. So I put it to Richard Dawkins. Let me try your question on yourself. You believe the universe created you. So tell me, who created your creator? I'm still waiting for the answer. Does that make sense to you? Well, think about it. Okay, that's that. If science started with Christians motivated by their worldview, where did it go astray, as so many scientists today are atheists? It's a perceptive question, and it's an important one, because there's obviously been a shift from the time of Newton through the Enlightenment to the present state in the Western world. And as we know, Newton developed a marvelous series of laws to describe the universe, planetary motion and so on, that looked like a machine. And people studied the universe as a machine and regarded it as only a machine. And gradually this mechanistic view got a little bit out of control, so that God started to retreat. He wasn't needed he was needed to start the machine. He was pushed back into the different distance, and that became the deism of the 18th century. But then people felt, well, do we need God at all? And so God has been pushed to the edge because, well, for many reasons, one of which I think is the reason I gave you, that people confuse mechanism and agency and sort of pitch God against science. Now, there were many other reasons, of course. In the 19th century, Thomas Henry Huxley, at the time of Darwin, didn't like the idea that so many scientists were clerics. They were amateur naturalists, and some of them were brilliant, of course. But he wanted a professional church of science, with the high priest being the scientist, a professional body, and so on. There was a big social dimension to it. And of course, there was the Enlightenment reaction in France to the domination of a church that in many places was corrupt. And les philosophes, the intelligentsia of France, gradually began to reject God, push him to the periphery as irrelevant to intellectual discourse. So there's a whole complex of reasons. And it's actually extremely interesting. I went to a lecture earlier this week in London, where Ian McGilchrist, who may be known to some of you, was expounding to us a fascinating thesis which has to do with psychiatry. He's a very distinguished psychiatrist, a fellow of All Souls. And he points out that a lot of research has been done recently into the brain. And our brain is two parts, the left-hand side, the right-hand side, connected by the corpus callosum. And research is being done on the different roles that these hemispheres of the brain play. And he is pointing out, his book is fascinating, it's called The Master and His Emissary. And what he's pointing out is this, that the left-hand side of the brain is the kind of calculating, reducing to particulars, scientific, rational, analytical part of the brain. And he said, we have in our education system emphasized that for the last couple of centuries to the exclusion of the other side of the brain, which is interested in unifying the bigger picture, the dimension of personhood and so on. And he said, what we're beginning to see now is in our society an increasing fracturing, because as human beings we're built with two sides to our brain. We need the bigger picture and we're not being given it. So people are inventing lesser pictures, meta-narratives, into which they fit their lives. And he says it's got to such a stage now, he was telling us, of primary school teachers in Canada that were telling him that children now cannot read their mother's face, still expression, because they see their mother sitting behind an iPad and a BlackBerry for hours and hours and hours, and the mother never looks at them. And the right-hand side of the brain has become underdeveloped. And we've emphasized this and emphasizing it so much that it has skewed the whole of our society into thinking that science is the only way to truth. Now, that's a very interesting approach from psychological science. And I found it most illuminating because it makes perfect sense. And so he says there is an enormous need. He said human beings, whether they know it or not, or like it or not, yearn for transcendence. And I would add, if they don't get the right kind, they'll get the wrong kind. So that is a little response to that. What do atheist scientists think created the universe? Well, again, Stephen Hawking is the most recent one to have gone on record in this, and I have a detailed analysis of it over there, but let me just point out what he thinks. Let me start with Peter Atkins. I was talking to Peter, I've debated him, and I said, Peter, what do you think created the universe? And he said, mathematics. So I started to laugh. He said, what are you laughing at? He was slightly piqued. And I said, Peter, that must be the most ridiculous statement I've ever heard, especially from a scientist. He said, why? I said, 2 + 2 = 4. Has it ever put £4 in your pocket? mathematics doesn't create anything. Any good financier will tell you that. I do believe there is such a thing as creative accounting. Notice the word creation comes in there. But you see the point I'm making, gentlemen. Mathematics creates nothing. There is a complete myth around, and Hawking has fallen for this as well. I mean, listen to the key statement of his book. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. You see, logically, if there isn't a God, you are forced to the position where the universe has got to be created from nothing. Now, analyze it. I love analyzing logic. You can see that. That's what I have in common with lawyers, you know. They analyze arguments. But most of you do that all the time. Particularly those of you who are in business. You are saying, weighing arguments. Well, let's weigh this one. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. So because there is something, the universe will create itself from nothing. Contradiction number one. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe will create itself from nothing. But you've just told us there's a law of gravity. And if there's a law of gravity, there's got to be gravity, because a law without something that it describes is meaningless. So because there is gravity, the universe creates itself from nothing. It doesn't. That is nonsense. And I had the opportunity just a few weeks ago at Harvard and MIT to debate publicly with the world's most famous cosmologist, Alan Guth. And I said, Alan, you know, I want to ask you something publicly. You physicists have a habit of talking about the universe being created from nothing, but you don't really believe that. Nothing, to most of us mortals, means non-being. If I go down the street and I say to you I met nobody, that doesn't mean I met somebody who's nobody. It means I didn't meet anybody. Isn't that right? And I said, you don't mean that, because your nothing is a quantum vacuum full of potentiality. And in public he said, you're right. It's not nothing in the philosophical sense. Yet we have Leonard Krauss, a world leading physicist, now weighing in on the atheist side, writing a book just a few weeks ago called A Universe from Nothing. Well, read his first chapter if you want a little lesson in how not to write philosophy. So it seems to me that the atheist is driven into a very difficult situation here. Because the big question that lies behind your question is, why is there something rather than nothing? If there is a God, that makes sense. God exists eternally. He calls it to be. But if there is no God, you're left with a big question. And if you say, oh, well, the laws of nature brought it into existence, but half a minute, the laws of nature are meaningless without there being a nature. So where did those laws come from? Where does nature come from? And any scientist worthy of his or her salt will admit that straight away. They haven't a notion at the level of a naturalistic explanation where those laws come from or where the universe came from. And the more I read, you don't have to know quantum physics or cosmology to follow an argument. And what amazes me is that these brilliant people with whose mathematics I have no quibble make deductions from it that one can get a sixth former to see are illogical. And I discover that I'm not alone in that response to Hawking's recent book. Do you consider there to be any evidence in support of faith in atheism? If so, what it is? I'll come to that in a little minute. I didn't agree with your point on morality as I understood it. Surely from an atheistic view, morality is developed as a social function, a commonly agreed set of principles that serve the collective purpose. Now, this could lead us into a long discussion. This is a very seriously important question. Because the dominant moral philosophy, at least in the West, is utilitarianism. The idea that the fundamental principle is the maximum good for the maximum number of people. Now, I've written in detail about this elsewhere, and it's thinking about this kind of question that led me to take a little bit of break in my Oxford career and do a degree in bioethics, to try to understand what was going on in some of these things. Of course, society and the notion of a contract and commonly agreed set of principles are extremely important. But the problem comes, this works very well when there's equal distribution of centers of power and authority. If you want to distribute ice cream to 100 children, you know exactly how you've got to do it or you're in trouble. Exactly millimetrically equal. Yeah? The problem comes with that principle is in saying you ought to follow it. If I get enough power so that I don't care what you do to me. And you say, ah, but you ought. I say, ought? What are you going to do about it? That's what Hitler did, of course. He made contracts when he was in his political infancy. He tore them up when he got the power. There are deeper issues here. And they deserve a much longer treatment. I find, you don't agree with my point, I appreciate it greatly. But the more I investigate this, I find that the attempt to base morality on anything other than the transcendent leaves you in a situation which we're seeing in our society. Our children are now believing it. That moral truth is relative. You have your truth, I have my truth. Why should I miss? Is the question that gets asked all the time. And how do you answer that? Huge corporations have collapsed, like WorldCom and Enron and so on. Because there's no real moral anchor. Now, it is the fact that there's a common pool of moral belief among people of every faith and none. That's there. We all know the difference between right and wrong. And that, of course, confirms to me the correctness of the statement of the Bible that tells us we're made in God's image. We are moral beings. But to earth it in nature in itself, an agreed set of common principles. But how do you get agreement? One of the massive problems in our world today is getting agreement. If there's no referent, if there's no referent that's external to you and me, if I hit you and you say it isn't fair, it shows that you expect me to accept the same moral standard as you. But what you're now facing in the society in which I live at least, is why should I? Why should I bother? So it is a deeper question, I think, and deserves thinking about. Now, what are these next things? What is your viewpoint regarding the age of the earth and the universe, given the disparity between the Christian and secular opinions, as well as scientific fact and speculation? And there's another question that seems to be about the same thing about the Old Testament. Now, here again, this is a huge question, and I have going to be once again shameless and tell you I've written a book about it. It's over there. It's called 7 Days That Divide the World. And I cannot now go into details about it, but it seems to me, the bottom line for me is this. I've been very concerned about many of my friends, particularly in North America, who are presented with an alternative. Either they accept the picture that the earth is less than 10,000 years old, and they're good Christians, and they're true Christians, or else they're not really Christians at all, and they bought into materialism and naturalism and so on. And many of my young American friends find themselves torn. They're keen on science, but they feel that they're going to have a huge conflict, which they are, of course. And so I've tried to write this book very sensitively, dealing head on with those questions. How do we make sense in an age of science of what Genesis says, and I believe very good sense can be made of it, by taking it seriously. Let me give you one example of that. The question says, what is your viewpoint regarding the age of the earth? Well, of course, my viewpoint isn't all that important. But the age of the earth, if you ask most scientists, they'll say the earth is about 4.5 billion years old, the universe is about 13.5 billion years old. What does the Bible say? Well, listen to what it says. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. When was that? Well, some people say that was day one of Genesis, was it? Because it's very interesting, gentlemen, that all the days of Genesis begin with the statement, and God said. That's not at the beginning of the book of Genesis. And my Hebrew scholar friends, whom I have consulted in great detail, point out to me that the first two verses of Genesis are written in a different tense from the rest of it, to indicate that the first two verses are describing something that happens before the sequence. So whatever you believe about the days of Genesis, Genesis itself doesn't claim that the earth is young. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. When was that? The Bible doesn't say, so I won't say either. And it seems to me that there's no reason not to believe what the cosmologists tell us. Of course, with a proviso, they may well change their minds. sometime in the future, you know. It's very interesting. I grew up, I'm that old, I grew up hearing people like Fred Hoyle, whom I knew a little bit, and used to discuss these things with him, hearing Fred Hoyle say the universe is eternal and so on. And then in the 1960s, the evidence for the hot Big Bang origin of the universe, there was a beginning, came in. And the editor of Nature at the time, Sir John Maddox, put an editorial in. I'll never forget it. We must not give in to these ideas that there was a creation, because they'll give too much leverage to people who believe the Bible. And here was a stunning scientific advance being resisted because it appeared to run parallel to Genesis, which of course it does. It's interesting, isn't it? And people say to me, you know, the Bible is anti-science and all that. That is piffle, nonsense. And you can show it's nonsense. First of all, the essence of all scientific work is taxonomy, giving names to things. If I went around this room and asked you to think of a word that I was unlikely to know, I bet you every one of you could come up with one from your professions. We put names on things. Yes? That's the essence of science. And where did that come from? Well, from God, actually. The very first task he gave to human beings was to name the animals. He started biology off himself. So to say God's anti-science is absurd. Point number two. The Bible is not a textbook of science. I don't, believe it or not, teach algebra from Leviticus in the University of Oxford. But it deals with different kinds of questions. But there is an overlap. It deals mostly, science does, with the how questions and the why of function, whereas the Bible talks about the why of purpose. But there is an overlap. The Bible does talk about this physical universe, the same universe that science talks about. Now, we have a model, a cosmological model, the standard model, the Big Bang model. We have a statement in Scripture, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. There's no conflict between those statements whatsoever. There is a conflict between the statement, God created the heavens and the earth in the beginning, and there was no beginning, it's a steady state universe. Do you see the point? It's talking about the physical universe, and where it talks about the physical universe, I think we have to take it seriously. Now, of course, people want to ask me about the days, but they weren't mentioned in the question, so I'm going to say nothing about them. Now, do miracles defy the laws of physics? There are two questions, in fact, three on that topic. And I'll give you a short answer to that question. Again, I'm afraid I've written about that extensively because there's a problem we come up against a lot. And people say, look here, we listen to all your talk about there being an intelligent God behind the creation and all this kind of thing. But look, man, you're a Christian. And you believe in things like the resurrection. We listened to Dawkins mock me at the beginning of my second debate with him in Oxford. He said we could talk about the God of Leibniz and the God of Einstein, but I don't need to talk about them because I've met John Lennox before. And he believes that Jesus walked on water and turned water into wine. Crazy, isn't he? Well, if Jesus rose from the dead and is the creator invented the universe, I don't see any particular problem in his capacity to turn water into wine or to demonstrate that he is the Lord of creation. But the key thing is, of course, does something like the resurrection of Jesus break the laws of nature, and so it's impossible for us to believe him? Now, all of this kind of thinking comes mainly from a Scottish Enlightenment philosopher. Now, I've got to be careful because I've got strong Scottish ancestry. And dear old David Hume. Miracles are violations of the laws of nature. They are not. David Hume is a very odd person to cite in this context because David Hume didn't even believe in the laws of nature because he didn't believe in the law of causality. And how he could say that miracles are violations of the laws of nature, which on his own hypotheses didn't exist, I just don't know. I find many people don't read Hume. They read people that quote Hume. And in one of my debates with Hitchens, he said, but didn't David Hume say? I said, Christopher, Hume actually is the worst person to quote. And after the talk, he came to me and he said, that was pretty heavy stuff. And I said, yes, it was heavy stuff. But I said, you know, Hume, if you read him, has no real valid objection to the miracles of the type described in the New Testament at all. And he said, but Richard Dawkins believes. I said, yes, he does. Like you, he's simply taken it from somebody else, thinking that Hume has done it. So let's cut this down to something simple. If you want to follow it, I've got a chapter at the end of my most recent book, Gunning for God, which does two things. Two chapters. One, analyzes Hume's arguments. Two, analyzes the evidence for the resurrection, looking at it through the eyes of David Hume. So I hope that little contribution has helped those who've come across Hume. But let me just come to the bottom line to help you think about this. Suppose I am staying in a hotel in London tonight, and I take money out of my wallet and I put £100 into my drawer. And the next night I put another £100 in and I got £200, yes? So on the third night I open the drawer and I find 50 quid. What do I say? The laws of arithmetic have been broken or the laws of England? Now think about it. Because thinking about it will show you that there's a difference in two concepts of law. And that's where the confusion lies. The laws of mathematics haven't been broken. Indeed, it's your knowledge of them that tells you somebody's put their hand into the system and stolen it. Do you see that? The thief doesn't break the laws of mathematics. They're totally intact. And they are the things that tell you that something has come in from outside. So, let's heighten that up to the New Testament. When Joseph discovered that Mary was pregnant, he knew as well as you do where babies come from. And so he wanted to divorce her. He knew the laws of nature. It took massive persuasion from God himself to convince him that this was something very special of the Holy Spirit. Do you see? The man who was born blind and Jesus healed pointed out to the religious authorities that didn't know what to make of him. He said, look, it hasn't been known from the beginning of the world that a man that has been born blind gets his sight back. You see, the irony of the whole thing, gentlemen, is this. That Hume made the point, and Dawkins makes it, everybody else makes it, that the people at the time of the New Testament were primitive, unscientific, pre-scientific. They didn't know the laws of nature so they could believe in miracles. That is sheer nonsense. Because where these things are discussed, we see that the people recognized the events as miracles precisely because they knew the corresponding laws of nature. If you think for a moment about the resurrection, if you didn't know that dead people don't normally rise, you wouldn't be the least bit surprised by resurrection, would you? You've got to know the corresponding law. So extrapolating from that backwards, we've got the situation where the universe has got to have two things for us to recognize something special. One, it's got to have a fairly consistent nature with built-in regularities. God's responsible for that. And we've got to know those regularities, otherwise we'd never recognize something that God does specially. He doesn't break the laws of nature. He would only break them if, not that that statement is even meaningful, I'm not sure it's meaningful. If we were claiming, I as a Christian was claiming, that Christ rose from the dead by natural processes going on in the tomb 5 minutes before it happened. But the Bible doesn't claim that. It claims it happened by the injection of colossal power of God, the like of which we cannot even begin to describe. And don't be embarrassed by that either. We don't even know what time is. We don't know what energy is. So, to understand the power of God, if I say I don't understand it, I'm only lining myself up with the much simpler things in the universe that nobody understands. So, that's the way I begin to approach that. And so, it seems to me that it's totally beside the point to argue falsely that miracles violate the laws of nature. You've got to approach the thing. These are specialized historical events. They're claims that certain things happened in history. So you approach them in that way. They're not scientific. You cannot say, right, we'll repeat the experiment and see whether Jesus rose or not. So we approach it not by the method of the inductive scientist, but the method of the forensic scientist. Did you ever hear Inspector Morse suggesting, let's rerun the murder and see what happened? Well, that's absurd. What you've got to do is investigate the evidence so suppose A did it. What would follow from that? Oh, that and that. That didn't happen, so therefore A didn't do it. And by an abductive approach, an inference to the best explanation, you come up, there's the probable murderer with such and such certainty. It's exactly the same with any historical event. How do you know that Caesar invaded Britain? Do you believe it? How do you know it? You see. Well, it's by this kind of inference. From history, we've got all kinds of bits of evidence. So that's the way I'd approach that. So that's that question. How much time have we got, sir? What? Oh, we're about done. Oh, that's marvellous. Can I say one more thing? I've been asked a very important questions about life beyond death, and I've been asked three questions about other religions. Can I spend 1 minute on that just very briefly? Because it's a very sensitive and important question. How do I approach the question of other religions? Well, first of all, with respect. With great respect. And I approach them with great respect because I find that in people of every religion and none, there's a common moral pool that I can respect. Sometimes atheists and people of other faiths can put Christians to shame. Right? So we accept that, but it's very important because it means we can have a discussion. Now, once you've realized that your friends, coming from different directions, have different beliefs, leave Christianity out of it. The Muslim is never going to agree with the Buddhist or with the Hindu, and vice versa, because their beliefs are so disparate. And to pretend that the beliefs aren't disparate is very foolish, because they are disparate. They're representatives of those faiths, and I've spoken to all of them many, many times. Want to discuss these things, provided it's done in a spirit of mutual respect, and not in a sort of looking down at you kind of thing. So my approach is very simple. Let me give one illustration of it. How do you decide? Well, I only know one way. What is the evidence you're presenting? These things are so serious and so important. If there is a God who created us, then ultimately the ultimate meaning of life is to have a relationship with Him. Is that possible? What do religions say about it? And I want to investigate that. Now, please don't feel insulted if you come from another faith tradition. But I can only tell you what has really struck me, and it's this, that let me do a bit of drawing in your imagination. When I talk to people about religion and philosophy, they generally tell me that their religion involves a way, that's a wavy line there, and it involves a gate at the beginning and a gate at the end. The gate at the beginning is some kind of rite of initiation or whatever. The gate at the end has got a pair of scales of justice, where merit is weighed, the good deeds from the end. And then I usually draw a few little professors with their hats on who are advising you as you go up and down on the way. Have you got it? That kind of picture. And most people will agree with me, even Christians, that this is their concept of religion. It's a bit like an Oxford University course, you see. You get into Oxford by some sort of ceremony, and then you go on the way, and the professors try and help you. But, of course, you're coming up against finals. And even the dear professors, and they always love you dearly, they can't guarantee you're going to get through, can they? Why? Because the whole thing is based on merit. That's the way it is in life, isn't it? Is it? And you see, the essential situation here is that if you're in the middle on the way, either down the trough or up in the mountain, it would be arrogant of you to say that I know that I'm going to get through finals. No, no, no. Humility tells you it depends on me. I can't, I have no certainty, no assurance that God or whatever it is up here, is going to accept me at the end. And I meet many people, particularly from my home country, who think that that's what Christianity teaches. It's the exact opposite of what Christianity teaches. Now, here it seems to me is one of the unique features that makes me a Christian. And it's this. That Christianity tells you right at the beginning, the induction is not a ceremony, it's a person. And we meet Jesus, and he tells us straight that we've got a radical disease, let me call it by its biblical name, sin. I come short of God's glory. And he tells me that I can know right now what's going to happen in the final judgment. I'm not going to get through because I've fallen short of God's standards. But now comes the big thing. He says, but you see, that's why I came. And you see on that wall back there, there are three crosses drawn by the children. Now, if that's God, what's God doing up there? And here is the stupendous heart of it all. That what Christianity claims is this: I cannot earn God's forgiveness by my merit. My parents were wonderful, but they weren't perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm a flawed man. I sin. And God says, I've come. And I've come to die for your sin. Now don't worry about the mechanics of it. That's another thing. I've discussed those again in great detail recently. But you can know acceptance right now. Because he that hears my word and believes on him that sent me has right now eternal life and shall not come into judgment, but has already passed from death unto life. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me say this with all sensitivity. Christ doesn't compete with anybody in this, because there's no one else offers this. So it's not as if he's competing with other religions. No one else offers this. And that is the knowledge of forgiveness which we all need, here and now. Now let me put it to you, finally, and I really mean finally. The way of merit appeals to us as being the way it must be, but we treat no human relationship like that. Suppose I met the girl that became my wife. I did meet her when she was 16 on day one at Cambridge. And I said to her, you know, Sally, I'd love you to be my wife, but of course I wouldn't dream of accepting you now. I mean, if you have a decent job and earn enough money for me to have good holidays and produce some nice children and buy me a yacht and make sure that you provide for my retirement, then 40 or 50 years I'll see about accepting you. You're laughing, somebody. Why are you laughing, gentlemen? That's the way millions of people think about God. It's exactly that. If I this, if I that, if I perform there, if I do this, well, God, maybe you'll accept me. If you said that, and please don't misunderstand me, but I must put it forcefully, I would be insulting her if I said that to her. Because the secret of our marriage is that the acceptance came at the beginning. And that's what has set her free to love me, instead of being afraid of rejection. Do you get that? God is a person. He's not a business executive measuring your performance. And he wants to have a relationship with you. And the wonderful thing, that's why I'm here this morning. I wouldn't have dreamed of coming to talk to you if I didn't have something to say to you which has thrilled my life from beginning to end and filled it with meaning. And that is, it's possible to know God. And it's possible to know forgiveness and peace with God. And that forms the solid foundation for life. So that's how I approach that question. And I say thank you to all of you.